Welcome to the deep dive. You sent us some really interesting material on the legal clash between BMW and MINI Works.
Yeah, it's a great case study.
What struck me right away is how this case unpacks the nitty-gritty of contract law when a valuable brand name is at stake.
Absolutely. And what your sources highlight so well is that a contract isn't just like a piece of paper signed on a particular day. It's validity, it's impact. It can evolve, based on what happens afterward.
Right, the context matters.
We're going to explore how a settlement agreement in this case was considered binding, even with a potentially late sign-off, and really get into this fascinating idea of an unwritten duty to play fair in any deal.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? Have you ever considered if a too late yes in a negotiation can still be?
Well, yes.
It's a common question. Or what if someone technically sticks to the rules of an agreement, but totally goes against its spirit? This BMW versus MINI Works situation throws up some surprising answers. And if you're ever involved in any kind of agreement, especially involving IP, intellectual property, the insights here are gold.
Totally. Valuable stuff for anyone dealing with contracts.
Okay, so let's dive in. What was the core issue that kicked off this legal back and forth?
Well, the central point of contention involved BMW, obviously the owners of the well-known MINI trademarks for their cars, parts, merchandise, all that stuff.
Right, the big car brand we all know.
Exactly. And then there's this company called MINI Works. They're in the business of selling, servicing, restoring used MINI vehicles.
Okay, sounds legitimate so far.
But,
Yeah.
and here's the kicker, they were also using the MINI trademark on things like clothing, accessories, without BMW's permission.
Okay, that's the sticking point, using the logo where they shouldn't.
Big problem. BMW has invested, heavily in building the MINI brand. Unauthorized use, it doesn't just confuse consumers.
Yeah, it waters down the brand image, as you say.
Precisely. It potentially dilutes the value, the exclusivity of their trademarks. That hits the bottom line,
Unauthorized use of a major trademark. Yeah, you can absolutely see why BMW would take issue with that.
Exactly. BMW did respond, sent cease and desist letters to MINI Works.
The standard first step.
Right. And they even opposed MINI Works' attempt to register the MINI trademark for themselves.
Oh, interesting move. They tried to claim the trademark.
Yeah. This ultimately led to the drafting of a settlement agreement. The goal was simple, really. Stop MINI Works from using BMW's trademarks without authorization.
So, a seemingly standard move to resolve a trademark dispute. That should have been the end of it, right? Sounds straightforward.
You'd think so. Not quite. Here's where the case takes an interesting turn. BMW claimed that even after MINI Works signed the settlement agreement, they continued.
Wait, so even after they signed the paper saying they'd stop?
Exactly. They allegedly kept using the MINI trademarks without permission.
Hmm.
This is where the legal waters get a bit deeper. The court had to consider not just whether the settlement agreement itself was valid, but also whether MINI Works' actions after signing it constituted a breach of that agreement.
This brings up a key question for me. If they signed an agreement promising to stop, why was the court even questioning if the agreement was legally sound in the first place? Wasn't the signing enough?
That's a really insightful question.
Yeah.
The timing of the acceptance was actually a crucial sticking point. See, BMW sent the settlement agreement to MINI Works with a deadline for signing and returning it.
Okay, a deadline makes sense.
MINI Works did sign it, but BMW alleged it was after that specified deadline.
Ah, so late to the party.
Kind of. And in legal terms, an acceptance that comes after the offer has expired isn't considered a proper acceptance of the original offer. Instead, it technically becomes a counteroffer.
Okay, so the initial yes was potentially past the due date, making it maybe not a real yes, legally speaking, at first, but the agreement was still upheld. How does that happen?
Right, well, here's where it gets really interesting, and the court's reasoning provides a valuable lesson. The court didn't just look at the date on the signature line.
What else did they look at?
They examined BMW's behavior after they received MINI Works' late acceptance. What they found was that BMW continued to act in a way that indicated they considered the agreement to be in full force and effect.
How so?
This included moving forward with actions consistent with the matter being settled under those agreed-upon terms. Like, they acted as if the deal was done. The key insight here, maybe for you listening, is that even if a deadline is missed, your actions afterward can essentially resurrect a deal. It's about whether you treat the agreement as alive or dead by how you behave.
So BMW's conduct after the fact essentially communicated, okay, your acceptance was late, but we're proceeding with this deal as if it were on time. They acted like it was valid.
Precisely. This is the legal principle of ratification. Think of ratification as officially saying yes later on, even if the initial yes wasn't perfect, maybe because it was late. BMW's actions showed they were essentially saying yes to the late acceptance by how they behaved.
Okay, that makes sense. Actions speaking louder than the missed deadline.
Exactly. Furthermore, the court also took into account Mini Works' own actions after they signed. There was evidence suggesting they had started to comply with some aspects of the agreement, like ceasing some of their unauthorized trademark uses.
So Mini Works also acted like the deal was on.
Right. This partial compliance also supported the idea that Mini Works themselves considered the agreement to be binding.
So it wasn't solely about the date of the signatures on the document, but the consistent behavior of both parties afterwards.
Interesting. What were the specific legal arguments the court had to weigh in all of this? There were three primary legal questions the court addressed. First, was there a valid settlement agreement established in the first place? This involved looking at the offer, the potentially late acceptance, and importantly, something called consideration.
Ah, yes, consideration, the quid pro quo.
Exactly. Was there a mutual exchange of value between BMW and Mini Works? Second, assuming a valid agreement existed, did Mini Works breach it by continuing to use the trademarks? And third, did Mini Works violate the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
The implied covenant keeps coming up. It sounds like a really crucial, but maybe less obvious element of contract law. Can you elaborate on what that entails exactly?
Absolutely. In Arizona, which is the jurisdiction for this specific case, and actually in many other legal systems too, every contract carries an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So not written down explicitly.
Correct. Think of it as an unwritten promise that both parties will act honestly and fairly towards each other. And importantly, they won't intentionally do anything to prevent the other party from receiving the benefits they reasonably expected from the contract.
Okay, so it's about the spirit of the deal, not just the letter.
That's a great way to put it. What's fascinating here is that you can actually breach this duty even if you technically adhere to the explicit written terms of the agreement.
Really? How?
It's like agreeing to play a game by the rules, but also agreeing not to intentionally try to sabotage your opponent, even if the written rules don't explicitly forbid that specific sneaky action. It's about fairness in the execution.
That's a really helpful analogy. So even if Mini Works could argue they didn't technically violate a specific clause in the settlement agreement, maybe point to some loophole, they could still be in legal trouble if their actions were seen as dishonest or as undermining the fundamental purpose of the agreement, which was to stop the trademark misuse.
Exactly right. The court recognized that a party can breach this implied covenant by denying the other party the reasonably expected benefits of the agreement. In the context of this settlement, BMW reasonably expected Mini Works to stop using their trademarks, right? That's the whole point.
That makes sense.
So, any actions by Mini Works that continue to cause consumer confusion or unfairly benefit from BMW's established brand reputation could potentially be seen as a breach of this unwritten duty to act in good faith.
So, what was the ultimate decision of the court regarding the validity of the settlement and these allegations of a breach? Did they decide everything?
Well, the court ultimately determined that a valid and enforceable settlement agreement did exist between BMW and Mini Works.
Okay, so the agreement stands.
Yes. Their reasoning was that even though Mini Works' initial acceptance appeared to be late, BMW's subsequent actions clearly indicated that they ratified the agreement, they accepted it through their behavior.
And Mini Works' actions, too.
And Mini Works' own partial steps towards compliance also suggested they considered themselves bound by the settlement. However, and this is key, when it came to whether Mini Works had actually breached the agreement or the implied covenant of good faith through their continued use of the trademarks,
yes,
the court found that there were still genuine disagreements about key facts, basically disputes over what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
These needed to be decided through a full trial.
So the court essentially said, yes, there's a binding deal here, definitely, but we still need to go to trial to figure out if you actually broke that deal or acted unfairly.
That's a very accurate way to summarize it. They granted what's called partial summary judgment for BMW on the question of whether the settlement agreement was valid, but they didn't make a final decision on the breach of contract and good faith claims. Those issues would need evidence presented, witnesses maybe, the whole trial process.
Okay, so for someone listening, maybe a law student or just someone interested in contracts, what are the most important takeaways from this case, the big lessons?
Yeah, there are several key principles at play here. First, the fundamental elements required to form a contract, you know, offer, acceptance, and consideration. They're always critical. You need those building blocks.
For basics.
Right. Second, this case provides a really clear illustration of the concept of ratification, demonstrating how actions taken after a potentially flawed acceptance, like a late one, can still create a binding agreement. Your behavior matters.
Actions speak louder than missed deadlines, as we said.
Exactly. And finally, it really highlights the importance of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. It reminds us that contracts are not just about the strict wording, the black and white text, but also about the fundamental expectation of fairness in how those agreements are carried out.
And why should someone really pay attention to this implied covenant? It sounds a bit vague, being implied, maybe less significant than the concrete terms written down. Why is it so important?
Oh, it's actually a vital protection against what we might call legal maneuvering or just acting in bad faith. Imagine a situation where someone finds a clever, technical way to comply with the literal terms of a contract, follows the rules exactly, but deliberately acts in a way that completely destroys the value of that contract for the other party.
Like finding a loophole to be unfair.
Precisely. The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing acts as a safeguard against such unfair outcomes. It ensures that parties operate honestly and reasonably when fulfilling their contractual obligations. So for you, thinking about any contracts you might encounter, this highlights that it's not just about the fine print, but also about the underlying trust and fair dealing you expect from the other party.
That makes a lot of sense. So for you, as someone keen on understanding knowledge thoroughly and maybe digging into these sources you sent us, this BMW versus MiniWorks case provides a really tangible example of how core legal principles like contract formation and these implied duties play out in a real-world business dispute.
Absolutely.
It really underscores that understanding the law isn't just about knowing the rules in a book, but also about grasping the nuances of behavior and the surrounding context.
Hmm.
What's the key message you'd want our listeners to take away from this deep dive, if there's one thing?
If I had to pick one, I think the most crucial takeaway is that in legal agreements, your actions speak volumes, often just as loudly as your signature. The BMW v. MiniWorks case clearly shows that even a late acceptance can become binding if your subsequent conduct demonstrates that you are treating the agreement as valid.
Ratification through action.
Exactly. Similarly, how you behave after an agreement is in place needs to align with the spirit of the deal and the fundamental expectation of fairness, that good faith idea. Consistency in your actions is absolutely paramount. What you do matters.
Thinking beyond this specific case, how might this principle of acting in good faith apply in other types of agreements you might encounter, even in less formal settings? Maybe even just day-to-day understandings.
That's a great question to ponder.
And could understanding this unwritten expectation potentially change how you approach future negotiations or agreements? It definitely provides some food for thought. Thanks so much for unpacking this complex case with us today. Really insightful.
It was my pleasure. Glad we could dive into it.
And thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the BMW and MiniWorks legal battle. We'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.